During the intermission, my slave helpers cleaned away the gruesome evidence of the slaughter from the set. I was particularly concerned that my Lady Lostry should not realize what had truly taken place in the first act. I wished her to believe that all had gone as we had rehearsed it, so I had arranged that she stay in her tent, and that one of Tanus' men remain at the entrance to keep her there, and also to ensure that none of her Cushite maidens were allowed to peep out at the first act and rush back to Lostry's with a report. I knew that if she realized the truth, she would be too distraught to play her part. While my helpers used buckets of water from our stage Nile to wash away the ghastly evidence, I hurried to my mistress's tent to reassure her and to satisfy myself that my precautions to shield her had been effective. "Oh, Taita, I heard the applause," she greeted me happily. "They love your play. I'm so happy for you. You so richly deserve this success." She chuckled in a conspiratorial fashion. "It sounded as though they believed the murder of Osiris was real, and the buckets of ox blood with which you drenched Todd were truly the blood of the god." "Indeed, my lady, they seemed totally deceived by our little tricks," I agreed, although I still felt faint and ill from what I had just lived through. My Lady Lostry suspected nothing, and when I led her out onto the stage, she barely glanced at the grisly stains that remained upon the stones. I posed her in her opening position and adjusted the torchlight to flatter her. Even though I was accustomed to it, still her beauty choked my throat and made my eyes sting with tears. I left her concealed by the linen curtains and stepped out to face my audience. There was no sarcastic applause to greet me this time. Every one of them, from Pharaoh to the meanest vassal, was captive to my voice, as in my lambent prose I described the mourning of Isis and her sister Nephthys at the death of their brother. When I stepped down, and the curtain was drawn aside to reveal the grieving figure of Isis, the audience gasped aloud at her loveliness. After the horror and blood of the first act, her presence was all the more moving. Isis began to sing the lament for the dead, and her voice thrilled through the gloomy halls of the temple. As her head moved to the cadence of her voice, the torchlight was reflected in a darting and flickering shaft from the bronze moon that surmounted her horned headdress. I watched Pharaoh attentively as she sang. His eyes never left her face, and his lips moved silently in sympathy with the words that swelled from her throat. "My heart is a wounded gazelle, torn by the lion claws of my grief," she lamented, and the king and all his train grieved with her. "There is no sweetness in the honeycomb, no perfume remains in the desert blossom. My soul is an empty temple, deserted by the god of love." In the front rank, one or two of the king's wives were snuffling and blubbering, but nobody even glanced at them. "I look on death's grim face with a smile. Gladly would I follow him, if he could lead me to the arms of my dear lord." By now, not only the royal wives, but every one of the women were weeping, and most of the men also. Her words and her beauty were too much for them to resist. It seemed impossible that a god should show the same emotions as mortal men, but the slow tears were cutting runnels through the white powder on Pharaoh's cheeks, and he blinked his heavy, coal-darkened eyelids like an owl as he stared at my Lady Lostris. Nephthys entered and sang a duet with her sister. Then, hand in hand, the two women went in search of the scattered fragments of Osiris' corpse. Of course I had not placed the actual dismembered portions of Todd's corpse for them to find. During the intermission, my helpers had retrieved these and carried them away to the embalmers on my instructions. I would pay for Todd's funeral out of my own purse. It seemed the very least that I could do to compensate the unfortunate creature for my own part in his murder. Despite the missing portion of his anatomy that Pharaoh still held in his hand, I hoped the gods might make an exception in his case and allow Todd's shade to pass into the underworld, and that there he might not think too badly of me. It is wise to have friends wherever you can, in this world and the next. To represent the body of the god, I had the funeral artists from the necropolis build for me a magnificent mummy cartonnage, depicting Osiris in his full regalia and in the death pose with his arms folded across his chest. This container I had cut into 13 sections that fitted together like a child's building blocks. As the sisters retrieved each of these sections, they sang a hymn of praise to the god's parts, to his hands and feet, to his limbs and trunk, and finally to his divine head. Such eyes like stars set in the heavens must shine for ever. Death should never dim such beauty, nor the funeral wrappings contain such majesty. When at last the two sisters had reassembled the complete body of Osiris, except for the missing talisman, they pondered aloud how they could return it to life once more. This was my opportunity to add to the pageant that essential element that makes any theatrical production appeal to the popular taste. There is a broad, lascivious streak in most of us, and the playwright and the poet does well to bear this in mind if he hopes to have his work appreciated by the main body of his audience. There is but one certain way to bring our dear lord and brother back to life. I placed the words in the mouth of the goddess Nephthys. One of us must perform the act of generation with his shattered body, to make it whole again, and to fan the spark of life within it. The audience stirred and leaned forward with anticipation at this suggestion. It had elements to appeal to even the most prurient of those present, including incest and necrophilia. I had agonized over how I would represent upon the stage this episode in the myth of the resurrection of Osiris. My mistress had shocked me when she had declared herself willing to carry her role through to the end. She had even had the effrontery to point out, with that impudent grin of hers, that she might gain some valuable knowledge and experience from doing so. I was not certain if she was jesting, or if she would really have gone through with it. However, I would not give her the opportunity to demonstrate her good faith or lack of it. Her reputation and the honour of her family were too valuable to trifle with. So it was that at my signal the linen curtains were drawn once more, and my Lady Lostries quickly left the stage. Her place was taken by one of the upper-class courtesans who usually plied her trade in a palace of love near the port. I had hired this wench from amongst several that I had interviewed because of her fine young body that so much resembled that of my mistress. Of course, in facial beauty, she could not come close to my Lady Lostries, but then I know of none who could. As soon as the substitute goddess was in position, the torches at the rear of the stage were lit so as to cast her shadow upon the curtain. She began to disrobe in the most provocative manner. The males in the audience cheered on her shadowy gyrations, convinced that they were watching my Lady Lostries. The harlot responded to this encouragement with an increasingly lewd display that was almost as well received as the slaughter of Osiris in the first act. Now came that action of the play that had given me, the author, considerable pause. For how could I contrive fecundity without a stout peg to hang it on? We had just seen Osiris forcefully deprived of his. In the end I was forced to stoop to that tired old theatrical device that I so scorned in the work of other playwrights, namely the intervention of the gods and their supernatural powers. While my Lady Lostries spoke from the wings, her shadowy alter ego on stage stood over the mummiform figure of Osiris and made a series of mystical gestures. "My dear brother, by the rare and marvellous powers granted to me by our forefather Amun-Ra, I restore to you those manly parts that cruel Seth so brutally tore from you," intoned my mistress. I had equipped the mummy case with a device that I could raise by hauling on a length of fine linen twine that ran over a pulley in the temple roof directly above where Osiris lay. At Isis' words, the wooden phallus, hinged to the god's pudenda, rose in majestic splendour, as long as my arm, into full erection. The audience gasped with admiration. When Isis caressed it, I jerked the string to make it leap and twitch. The audience loved it, but loved it even better when the goddess mounted the supine mummy of the god. Judging by the convincing acrobatics of her simulated ecstasy, the harlot I had chosen to play the part must have been one of the truly great exponents of her art. The audience gave full recognition to her superior performance, egging her on with whistling and hooting and shouting ribald advice. At the climax of this exhibition, the torches were extinguished and the temple plunged into darkness. In the darkness, the substitution was made once more, and when the torches were relit, my Lady Lostries stood in mid-stage with a newborn infant in her arms. One of the kitchen slaves had been considerate enough to give birth a few days previously, and I had borrowed her whelp for the occasion. "I give you the newborn son of Osiris, god of the underworld and of Isis, goddess of the moon and of the stars." My Lady Lostries lifted the infant high, and he, astonished by the sea of strangers before him, screwed up his tiny face and turned bright red as he howled. Isis raised her voice above his and cried, "Greet the young Lord Horus, God of the wind and the sky, falcon of the heavens. Half the audience were Horus men, and their enthusiasm for their patron was unbounded. They came to their feet in a roaring tumult, and the second act ended in another triumph for me, and in mortification for the infant god, who on later examination was found to have prodigiously soiled his swaddling cloth. I opened the final act with another of my recitations describing the childhood and the coming to manhood of Horus. I spoke of the sacred charge laid upon him by Isis, and as I did so, the curtains were drawn aside to reveal the goddess in the centre of the stage. Isis was bathing in the Nile, attended by her handmaidens. Her wet robe clung to her body so that the pale glory of her skin shone through. The indistinct outlines of her breasts were tipped with tiny rosebuds of virgin pink. Tanus, as Horus, entered from the wings, and immediately dominated the stage. In his polished armour and his warrior's pride, he was a perfect counterpoint for the beauty of the goddess. The long list of his battle honours in the river wars, together with his most recent exploit in saving the royal barge, had focused the attention of the populace full upon him. For this moment, Tanus was the darling of the crowd. Before he could speak, they began to cheer him, and the applause continued so long that the actors were forced to freeze in their opening positions. While the cheering swirled around Tanus, I picked out certain faces in the audience and watched their reactions. Nembet, the great lion of Egypt, scowled and muttered fiercely into his beard, making no attempt to hide his animosity. Pharaoh smiled graciously and nodded slightly, so that those seated behind him were made aware of his approbation, and their own enthusiasm was encouraged. My lord Intef, never one to fly against the prevailing winds, smiled his most silky smile, and nodded his head in concert with his king. His eyes, however, when seen from my vantage point, were deadly. At last the applause abated, and Tanus could speak his lines, not without difficulty, however, for every time he paused to draw breath, another outburst of cheering broke out. It was only when Isis began to sing that complete silence fell upon them once more. The suffering of your father, the terrible fate that hangs over our house, all these must be expunged. In verse, Isis warned her noble son, and held out her arms to him in supplication and in command. The curse of Seth is upon us all, and only you can break it. Seek out your monstrous uncle. By his arrogance and his ferocity you will know him. When you find him, strike him down, chain him, bind him to your will, that the gods and all men will be freed for ever from his ghastly sway. Still singing, the goddess withdrew and left her son to his quest. Like children following a well-loved nursery rhyme, the audience knew full well what to expect, and leaned forward eagerly and hummed with anticipation. And when at last Seth came leaping back on stage for the cataclysmic battle, the age-old struggle between good and evil, beauty and ugliness, duty and dishonour, the audience was ready for him. They greeted Seth with a chorus of hatred that was spontaneous and unfeigned. In defiance, Rasfer leered and gibbered at them, strutting about the stage, cupping his genitalia in his hands and thrusting his hips out at them in a mocking and obscene gesture that drove them wild with fury. "Kill him, Horus!" they howled. "Smash in his ugly face!" And Seth pranced before them, stoking their fury. "Kill the murderer of the great god Osiris!" they roared in a paroxysm of loathing. "Smash in his face! Rip out his guts!" The congregation's reaction to him was in no way moderated by the fact that it knew deep down that this was Rasfer and not Seth. "Hack off his head!" they screamed. "Kill him! Kill him!" At last Seth pretended to see his nephew for the first time, and swaggered up to him, lolling his tongue out between his blackened teeth, drooling like an idiot, so that silver strands of saliva slimed down onto his chest. I would never have believed that Rasfer could make himself more repulsive than nature had already accomplished, but now he proved me wrong. "Who is this child?" he demanded, and belched full in the face of Horus. Tanus was unprepared for this, and stepped back involuntarily, his expression of disgust unfeigned as he smelled Rasfer's breath and the contents of his stomach, the sour wine still fermenting in it. Tanus recovered swiftly and spoke his next line. "I am Horus, son of Osiris." Seth let out a mocking peal of laughter. "Ha ha! And what is it you seek, boy child of a dead god?"